VentureCast.
Charlene Lamb is a certified grief coach, speaker, and the curator of the Grief Gallery. After the death of a loved one, she helps grieving people who feel weighed down by all the stuff, both physical and emotional. After her mother died suddenly in 2013, Charlene leaned into her creativity and instincts as a curator to guide herself through grief. From that, she developed her curating grief coaching framework to help people heal in a creative, accessible way. Because when you lose a loved one and you do a lot of thinking about how they lived, you naturally start asking yourself, how do I want to live? For Charlene, that included starting a business and a transatlantic move in the midst of a pandemic. This is her story of losing her mother and finding herself.
1, 2, 3, 4.
You're listening to Permission to Live. I'm your host and certified life coach, Melissa Lyon-West. Here on Permission to Live, we're going to share powerful stories of women who turned a midlife crisis into a badass life. We'll share the good, the bad, and the ugly that comes when you finally say yes to yourself and why it is always worth it. Charlene, thank you for coming on Permission to Live.
Thank you.
Your story is like all over the globe. It intersects with grief of losing a mother, which I'm like right in the midst of myself. So that's just such a conversation that I'm excited to have with you. Because it's not talked about. Grief is not talked about in our society. And so, yeah, I'm excited to just dive in
and hear your story.
I mean, you have lived in London. You're now in Portugal. You were in New York. You work for a communications consultant. Now you're a grief counselor. Tell us how you got here.
Yes. Well, this is the interesting thing about grief, right? That you're experiencing now. Lots of love.
Thank you.
My mom died 10 years ago this month. And our experiences are quite different circumstance-wise, but like loss is such a universal experience. So that's what I find really interesting too. I am originally from New York. So that's the New York part. My mom was also a proud Chinese American New Yorker. And I also lived in London for 8 years. And I was living in London when my mother died suddenly. And she was living in New York at the time. And yeah, I moved to Portugal about a year and a half ago. So it's a lot of crisscrossing the Atlantic.
You've been all over the place. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. And that's throughout my life. So it's fitting. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's back up to 2013. You're living in London at the time. You're working with creatives, right? Okay. You're working as a curator.
Yes.
Which ties into your whole story, which is something that is, it's very, as like a creative person myself, I was very drawn to that aspect. And so I'm excited. Okay, getting ahead of myself. I'm excited to get into that. But let's go 2013. You're living in London. And you said it was sudden, right? When your mom passed.
Yeah. Like roll it back. Actually, roll it back even a little further.
Okay.
But it's always been like creatives and stories. Like I wanted to be a journalist. I, you know, was the editor of my high school newspaper. And then in school, I was like, oh, mass communications and all that stuff. All about storytelling. And in London, I was doing this kind of storytelling in a different form. I was working with creatives, like artists and designer makers, and I was helping them to tell their stories, both in a marketing sense and on social media, but also in a physical sense. I was doing pop-up shops and exhibitions, selling their work. And in 2013, I was looking ahead to the year. I remember that I tweeted, I have a feeling this is going to be a good year.
Oh, no.
And then it's just like a movie, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you get an email from a relative and they're like, have you heard from your mom? She hasn't gotten back to me in a while. And it turned out that my mother, who lived in New York, like I said, she had a stroke totally out of the blue. We didn't know she was sick. She didn't really even know she was sick. And apparently it was immediate and she was gone. And it was so out of the blue. I always describe it as feeling like I was blindsided, thinking that, 2013, good year, picking up momentum in my creative work, looking forward to the exhibitions I was going to do. And then everything changes.
Yeah. Yeah. I resonate so much with that because that's how last year started for me. I had just quit my job. I had just started my business full time. And I was like, this is the year. This is going to be amazing out of the blue. You know, for us, it was 2 weeks. We found out she was sick and 2 weeks later she was gone. And it does. It's like a train just comes out of nowhere and barrels into you and you don't know if you're up or down or where you are or what's going on.
Yes. And I find that language of disaster is so common, right? Like, I think of a car crash. You talked about a train. Mm-hmm. Other people have said it's like a bomb went off.
Yeah.
And when the loss is sudden like that, I think we very much have that sense of what happened. Yeah. We're often in shock and kind of reeling around and trying to pick up the pieces of our lives and also their life.
Yeah.
And for me, what that looked like was, oh, I guess I need to book a flight.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm an only child, and I knew that a lot of the responsibility was going to be mine. Even though I had the help of my aunt, I knew I had to get back to New York as soon as possible.
Right.
So I was still in shock, but I booked my flight. And when I got there, I went directly to my mother's house. And my mother's house was this 3,000 square foot dream house that she had bought and renovated just a couple of years before she died. She had divorced my father a couple of years ago and moved back to New York, which is really where she lived and was considered, she considered that her hometown, where her friends were. And she was kind of living her dream life, reconnecting with old friends and decorating the house how she wanted. And it was this house that was just full of stuff, her stuff, right? A lifetime of belongings. And I had the task of deciding what to do with the house. And eventually deciding to put it up for sale because there was a big mortgage on it. And I couldn't afford to keep it, which meant I had to empty it.
Which is a monumental task in the middle of, like you said, you're in shock, you're grieving. I'm just thinking about this. I'm overwhelmed for you 10 years ago.
Right. I feel so much compassion for me back then. And it's not an unusual situation, which is the crazy thing, right? We lose someone. This big thing happens in our lives, and suddenly we're expected to make big decisions. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we're supposed to plan a funeral right away. In what other circumstance does something terrible happen to you, and then society expects you to plan a party?
Right. And on top of dealing with all of their earthly things.
Yes.
It's a lot. Yeah. When you think about it like that, right? Like, you would never plan this big event when you're in crisis.
No.
And yet that's exactly what it is.
Yeah. Suddenly we're supposed to do all this. So that's partially what led to me eventually deciding to help other people with grief and with that aftermath of losing someone. Because even back then, I was thinking to myself, how am I expected to do this? My life is an ocean away. And now I've got this house full of stuff to deal with, as well as all the paperwork. And I put my life on hold for 2 years professionally. And my husband was working in London, so he stayed there. And I flew back and forth for quite a while. It cost a lot of money.
Yeah.
Burned up all my miles. And it was really the stuff, though, that was a sticking point. It's very common now that I've talked to a lot of people about their stuff and the belongings of their loved one to experience that feeling of, oh my God, I can't let go of anything. Everything feels so precious.
I know that feeling, right? When my grandmother passed away, everything, stuff we didn't even know she had, and it had no emotional attachment in our memories. It wasn't like, oh, this is hers. We kept everything. We divided it up among all of the grandkids and all of the kids. And we were like, we can't get rid of anything because it feels like you're getting rid of that person.
Yeah.
So yes, so here we just planned a funeral. We're in all of this grief and we're like, we are keeping every single thing, which is a lot. It's a lot to bring into your life when you're bringing in all of these items that belong to somebody else into your own life. It's a lot.
Absolutely. And like we get so attached, mm-hmm. right? And it's all these layers of circumstances as well. I had the privilege of keeping my mom's house for over a year, burning through money. But I didn't feel emotionally ready to mm-hmm. let go of it yet as right. I was processing all this. And certainly other people don't have that luxury of being able to keep the house or being able to afford a storage unit. Or in your case, it sounds like you even had people to give stuff to. That can be a luxury.
Well, we were all, she lived out of state from mm-hmm. us. And so it was like, we had to get rid of all the stuff, empty out the house within days, really. And
oh, so okay. it was like, days. That's hard. That's very hard.
Yeah. So it was like, you take all of this. And over time, at least for me, I did pare down what mm-hmm. I kept of hers.
Yeah.
Because you do get to the point where you realize this stuff is not her. This stuff doesn't actually help with the pain. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And yeah, so this idea of curating things that mean something more. Yeah, tell me more about that.
Yeah. And I think what you speak to is all these stages of curating, because it's not just one time that you choose. I very much found that that was an iterative process. For me, I didn't have a couple of days. I had longer. Again, very grateful for that. But when I did decide to list the house for sale, I realized, okay, I really do need to start letting things go. Mm-hmm. And the only way that I could do it was to put on my curator hat, because I was used to making choices for my exhibitions. And I asked myself the question of, okay, let's pretend I'm going to do an exhibition about my mother, and which 100 objects would I choose to display? And that question was actually what got me going. I mean, like, as a daughter, you know, like you said, everything feels so precious. Oh my gosh, this one, you know, her toothbrush, it has her DNA on it. This was, you know, she carried it back from a vacation, so it must have meant a lot to her. And then there were expensive things from my family that I thought I needed to do something with. There were just so many decisions in that house. And putting on my curator hat and kind of giving myself that creative brief, that's what actually led to making decisions.
Yeah. It switches. Instead of what do I have to get rid of, it's saying what are the 100 things I want to keep?
Yes.
And it takes the pressure off of like, I see how just that switch in mentality can make such a big difference emotionally.
What's most important?
Right.
Right. What does our heart immediately say? And though I always say, well, I'm not a professional organizer, right? If it was as simple as, you know, the Marie Kondo thing of, does it spark joy? Well, if you had a good relationship with your person, and I think I did have a good relationship with my mother. For some people, if we just asked, does it spark joy? Some people would want to keep everything.
Yeah.
Which is not necessarily preferable. Let's say that. But from that question of curating and imaginary exhibitions, I did do a physical exhibition in London in 2015, and it was beautiful. Like, I showed some of my mother's things, and it really felt like the real first step in me healing and really processing my own grief. Because before then, I was so focused on, I have to be responsible. I have to deal with the house. I have to deal with the paperwork. And I think looking at her things, putting it into a physical exhibition, sharing that with people, really helped me to tap into the emotional processing that I hadn't been able to access before.
Yeah, there was no space, right? Like, the responsibility was taking up all the space. So you get to this point and you're like, okay, I can like finally deal with all these feelings. Yeah. So you took the 100 things out of her house. Did you donate and get rid of everything else, and you just kept those 100 things?
I would say it's like a creative construct to get started. I did have someone ask me at a talk, you know, did Charlene keep the 100 objects? And I would say the 100 objects question got me started. Mm. And then some things, I'm sure I kept more than 100. Of course, it depends on how we count, right?
True,
right?
Yes.
Like, the individual spools of thread, like, are those all counted as one?
Right. Right. So it's not like a specific set of rules. It's this idea.
Yeah.
This creative way of dealing with the grieving process.
Yeah. And making choices. Because I always say, I define curating as choosing with intention. Mm-hmm. That when I'm doing an exhibition, I'm not putting in all the work that an artist has done. I am choosing the pieces with intention that I want to put in this exhibition for a particular experience or to explore a particular theme. So I think of that for the objects and the belongings as well. It's like, how do we choose with intention? And that 100 objects question was helpful in that moment to get me started thinking about it. And I think I am kind of tempted at the 10-year mark to actually do a formal 100 objects about my mother, in which case I really would choose 100 and limit myself to that 100 and to tell the stories about those objects. But I'm very much in favor of doing what's helpful for us. Like, I didn't actually need the stress of limiting myself to 100.
Yes, exactly. Right. Like, yes, what is helping us, not what is what is putting extra pressure and weight on us when it's already such a emotionally charged time.
Yeah. And the circumstances of that time, right? Everything needed to fit in a suitcase. Mm. I needed to bring it back over across the ocean, back to London with me, or it would need to go out in a storage unit. And I do often confess that, or I won't even say confess, right? I'll just say that openly. I had a storage unit for 8 years because there were things that were just too painful to deal with, that were painful to me, or painful moments from my mom's life that I just didn't know how to deal with physically or emotionally at that point. And also just on a practical sense, I didn't want to get rid of my grandmother's sewing machine, which was this big Singer sewing machine with an attached table. But I couldn't take that on the plane with me.
Yeah.
So that's the storage unit.
Yes, never any shame, right? Never any shame for how we have to take time and process. And I love hearing this. I just did a podcast with somebody talking about she didn't even begin to deal with her grief for 10 years. And I love hearing all of these different perspectives on time and grief, because it is not linear. It is not, I just watched a video of yours where you're like, look, there are the 5 stages of grief, but that's been taken out of context. It's not like 1, check, 2, check. And it just gives you, there's so much, I guess it gives so much humanity and empathy to this conversation around grief, because
absolutely,
it's so nuanced. And even you mentioned, like, how was your relationship with the person you lost? Like, I mean, talk about nuance, right? And yeah, so having a storage
and complications and complexities.
So complex. Oh my goodness. We could get into that. I'm sure we will.
Yes.
but needing a storage unit for 8 years as you just heal in ways until you're ready. That's okay. Yeah. That's normal. That's all right.
Yeah. And again, like, if you can afford it, if you have the privilege of being able to afford that, was that the best use of my money? Would, you know, Susie Orman or the financial advisors think that that's advisable? Probably not. But I knew that I needed to do it.
Like, and making the choice, you're like, it was right for me. It was right to spend that money. That's what I needed. And that's okay.
Yeah. And I think it's supporting those choices, you know, of being compassionate. I've been thinking a lot about being compassionate to our past selves, because I think it's easy to look back and think, oh, I should have just been stronger. I should have dealt with the storage unit earlier. I should have made a different choice. And I think that's not helpful either. Having compassion for our past selves and the decisions we made then, I think is actually a really important part of not adding additional pain to what's already painful.
I talk with my clients a lot about this, about having that empathy and compassion for yourself 5 years ago, 10 years ago, a year ago, 6 months ago, when you made a choice that you wouldn't make now because you have different information now. Or you've healed, or you feel differently. But what you just said it so perfectly. You add so much pain and weight to your current self when you judge your past self.
Exactly. And it's a lot of that, right? That's what we see a lot of. It's already an inherently painful situation to lose someone that you loved, or even if the relationship was complex, someone you were attached to. So there's already pain there. And what we see so often is additional pain, unnecessary pain from that self-judgment. Like you said, the misconceptions about what grief looks like, about how long you should be grieving. This is what we're seeing. So many people kind of questioning themselves and asking, am I doing it right?
Do it right? I have asked myself that so many times this year. Am I doing this right? And my sisters and I will get on the call like, how do you feel? Okay, that's not how I feel. And we're all like, wait a second. We're all different people. We all had different relationships with my mom, right? But yes, this feeling of like, am I doing this right? Like for me, you know, I hadn't seen my mom in years before she passed away. I hadn't been on the property, like where the commune was. And so going back to that, not only was the shock of her passing, like I was not expecting that, then going back and being in a place and surrounded by so many triggers. When I came back, I was a mess. I was mentally unstable. I started having suicidal ideation. I was in such a terribly dark place. And thankfully, I had support around me, and I was able to get, you know, mental help and the support that I needed to work through that. But even in that, I was like, wait a second, this doesn't happen to people I know. Maybe I'm doing this wrong, which is so ridiculous, right? Like outside of it, I can look back and be like, oh, you like, yes, you were just, there was so much. But that question of, am I doing this right, is so ridiculous and yet so prevalent.
So prevalent, so common. And I think it also makes sense. We don't really talk about what it's like. We somehow, for this experience that we're all going to experience in some form, we don't talk about it until it's happened. And then we're in shock. We're upset. We are emotionally strained. And then we are Googling what to do when a person dies.
Oh my goodness. You have just exactly described my last year. Like, what am I supposed to do? What are the steps? How do I feel? Mm-hmm. How do I feel? Google, please tell me.
Yeah. What am I supposed to do? Am I doing this right, Google?
Yeah.
Yeah. And it feels all very high stakes, mm-hmm. right? If you're dealing with an estate, suddenly you're dealing with lawyers. And if you're dealing with other people and their emotions and their potential reactions, it just all feels really high stakes. So I think that adds to that feeling of, oh, am I doing it right? Because if I do it wrong, there might be major consequences.
Right. And you're like, well, I can't go back. I can't go back and redo this. If I'm making a mistake now, yeah, man, the high stakes, the high pressure, all of that is just, this is what I love about this conversation, is that you are giving words to things that we're all going to experience, that we have experienced, that we're currently going through, that we don't talk about, which is why I have been so excited for this conversation. Because when we have words for what we're feeling and what we're going through, when we have permission to feel any which way we need to, when we have somebody who's saying, this is okay, and this is okay, and if you do it this way, it's okay, it takes so much of that stress and that pressure off of what you've already said is just such an emotionally charged time. Mm.
And it's that naming, acknowledging, and normalizing, right? What you've described for yourself too, it is such a dark time. And I'm so glad that you got the help that you needed. And I do think that there's this whole range of support that people need and hopefully can access. And I think that's part of what drives me to do what I do, because instead of people Googling and just hoping they can find the support they need, to tell people about the range of support that's out there and to consider what kind of support they might need, because there is something about normal grief. Like we said, naming what's happening and saying like, hey, it's normal to feel angry one moment and like super sad the next. And that's normal. Not everyone experiences grief in the same way. You might need more help if there are complications, if it's taking you to a really dark place where there's suicidal ideation. That's where therapy, that's where medical professionals come in. And there's a place for what I do, which is grief coaching, which is about helping people to process normal grief. We don't have to pathologize it, which unfortunately in American culture often happens because of how our healthcare system works and how we think about mental health in general. So that's part of like it too, to say normalizing grief, which I think we're talking about more in society because of pandemic and with more celebrities talking about loss in the last couple of years and recently. So that's good to see that we're talking about it more.
Yes.
Like we are now.
Yes, exactly. Because we're all going to go through it one way or mm-hmm. another.
Yeah.
It's part of life. Death and grieving is part of life. And when it's not talked about you, you feel so alone. I know I felt that way. Mm-hmm. Thankfully, I have, you know, my siblings were also, we're able to have like, well, once a month or so we'll get on and we'll be like, how are you doing? How are you feeling?
I love that.
Yeah. And so that has been really helpful in normalizing like, well, I'm going through this and I don't know if that's okay. And everyone will be like, that's okay. You're okay. And then somebody mm-hmm. else will be like, well, I'm experiencing this way.
And we all process in different ways. So that's been interesting too. When I was looking back at why was that so helpful for me? It was really interesting to see how this idea of curating and being creative, how it ties into different kinds of contemporary grief theory. because there have been a lot of advancements made in grief theory in the last decades, where when we talk about the five stages of grief, that is from 50 years ago.
Okay.
And as you said, it's a misconception. It was originally around people who are facing terminal illnesses themselves. And those were the stages of grief that that terminally ill person was experiencing. That's what Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's research was about. And somehow that got misconstrued to be like the grief that the people who are left behind feel. And some people do feel it's helpful to name stages. And I definitely see that. Like, I'm a research person myself. I want a checklist, right? I want a binder. But when people think that, oh, there is a right and wrong way to do this, I need to go through it in this order, and then I will graduate and get my certificate, and I will be done with grief. Those misconceptions and misunderstandings, I think, really contribute to that self-judgment and questioning. Yes. Of, am I
doing it right? Yeah.
So I love the creative aspect to it, because I don't think it's a heavy subject. I think it's a really interesting subject. But for a lot of people, I understand, you know, they don't want to talk about death. They don't want to look at grief. And my hope is by approaching it from a creative way and from this kind of curating approach, that it is more accessible. It does feel more doable for people.
Yeah, this is so intriguing to me. I was looking at some of the things on your site, and I don't really have access to a lot of my mom's things. Mm-hmm. She moved a lot, so a lot of her things were not kept. And I was looking, I think I saw somebody who had drawn pictures or had created some kind of artwork around their mother's things. And that sparked some interest in me. And I was like, you know what? That would be such an interesting process, mm-hmm. to create artwork around the things that I remember that meant a lot. And especially because my mom, she was across the country. And then because of my situation with leaving the religion, there was also some complications, I guess you could say, with the relationship there. And I was thinking about just curating the ideas of what I remember and creating that artwork around that. And it just, I mean, it kind of makes me emotional right now just thinking about connecting with her. Yes. In that way, even though, yeah, it's not her physical things, it's these memories of the physical parts of her life and what we shared and what I remember.
Absolutely. You hit it right there, right? It's curating, making choices, but it really is about connecting. And there's this other theory of grief called continuing bonds theory that I think is very helpful for people. And that was another shift where that was introduced about 30 years ago. And before then, there was really that kind of thinking about it as moving on. You grieve. You do the tasks of grieving, and then you move on with your life. And there was really kind of more that idea that, oh, you leave it behind. You leave the person behind, you leave the experience behind. And continuing bonds theory says, well, no, actually, we keep the bond. We stay connected with the person in different ways. And that can be in our hearts and in our heads. And for my purposes, I think in our physical spaces, that can be very helpful as a way to stay connected. And like you said, commissioning art, creating art, curating, because you can curate a display in your home, right on a shelf. Mm-hmm. To me, that's curating something that is an exhibition. You are making choices, and that can be an artwork because not everyone does have the physical items.
I love the concept of bringing the creativity and the artwork into the grief, mm-hmm. and alongside with. And it's all because I know personally, and well, I'll only speak personally, sometimes you just get so, you almost feel trapped in it. You feel trapped in the grief and trapped in your head and in the thoughts and trying to figure out how I'm supposed to carry all of this. How am I supposed to, is it ever going to change? Is it always going to feel like this? And it can just feel so heavy. Mm-hmm. And the thought of this creative outlet for the grief, the creative outlet to staying connected to somebody, it was like a lightness. It brought like a lightness, and it brought a little bit of hope, you know, to the grieving process. I love it so much where it's, you don't feel, yeah, it's that outlet, that creative outlet. And I had never heard of it within grief before and within this curating process. And it's, It's so powerful. It's so powerful.
I think so.
Yes. Yes.
I mean, I think that's the interesting thing, right? That there's a whole world of this out there that we don't hear about. There's art therapy for grief. Like, there's a program that I'm going through to learn some of the approaches because, like you said, a creative outlet. Mm-hmm. An outlet because this is something that needs to move through us, that we need to have it move through us and out of us. And I think sometimes when we are thinking people, when I had a lot of CBT, which is, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy, I am very much a give me a framework, give me a checklist, like I said. So we think that we can think our way through it when really there's emotion that gets stuck in our bodies as we're learning a lot more about. And there's a school of thought that grief needs to be metabolized, like digested through your body. And we do need these outlets to get the emotions, to get the grief moving through us so it doesn't get stuck in us. Yes. And creativity can be such a welcoming, gentle, even joyful way to do it. It was certainly the most accessible to me.
I use movement to move a lot of my stuck feelings, mm-hmm. especially my past trauma, like nonlinear movement, dance, shaking, yes. to get it out of me. But I think something that really resonated with me and around this curating it and this artistic way of approaching grief, or not just approaching it, but incorporating. Sometimes I feel like if I release the grief, I'll release the memory, I'll release the person. Mm-hmm. And which is not right. It's not true, but that's how I feel sometimes, right? If I release this weight, this pain, then maybe that means something about me. Maybe that means that I'm not sad anymore and I didn't love her. You know, all the thoughts that we get trapped up in our heads. And so this process of using art to curate items that mean something and select, it's this way of moving that emotion and moving yes. that pain and that grief, but in a way that I feel so connected. So it's moving that pain out, but it doesn't feel like, oh, I'm losing her.
Yes.
And yes. I just felt so connected to that thought of like, okay, this could be a really healthy way for me to move this out while strengthening that love and that bond. That, mm-hmm. you know, that, yeah.
Yes, you totally got it. Yeah. That, and people do think that if I release the grief, I'll release the person. If I get rid of the piano, I'm letting my grandmother down, mm-hmm. right? There are all these kind of meanings. Because like you said, it means something about me. And that is such an important part of this. When we think about an object, is there a particular object of your mom's that you can think of that you might want illustrated or that has a particular memory for you?
Oddly enough, the first thing that I thought of was her mm-hmm. lipstick and the way yes. that she put on her lipstick, like rounded the top. And I always kind of like joked around and like made fun of her. Like that was so weird to me. But now that she's gone, it's like one of these things that I just think, and I just thought like that would be so beautiful as an art print.
Yes.
But just this like tube of lipstick and the maybe the top on the side. And yeah, just that stuck out to me.
Yes. So it, and this isn't this phenomenon, right? When people think about what people attach value to, sometimes we think, oh, it's going to be the expensive heirloom piece. When really the things with the most emotional charge can be those everyday things like the lipstick. And my mom's lipsticks, I still have those. Her shape was not rounded. So even that's distinctive from my mom to your mom, right? But what I find so interesting about things, these mundane things like the lipstick, this is obviously a meaningful object for you. But if someone else was to come across the lipstick, it probably wouldn't have that same level of meaning.
Of course, it would be thrown in the trash, right? Like, yeah.
Yeah, which I find so fascinating about this work. And I use that exercise of like looking objectively at an object with clients because, well, we get a lot of conflict when people have different definitions of what is meaningful mm-hmm. or if they have different meanings that they attach to objects. So we do a lot of creative exercises to be able to look at that. But I love imagining this stick. What shade is it?
It's red. That's a bright red. So a little darker, but yeah, so not like true red, a little darker.
Yeah. And what's like the case? Is there a certain color or brand black, that you liked?
Black and with a gold band.
So very distinctive. My mom's were always like golden. I think they were L'Oreal. So it's kind of like this practice of we on the Zoom call, it's like we're in a gallery space. And it's like we have, you know, the white display pedestal that you see in galleries. And you've placed your mother's lipstick on it. And I feel like we're gazing at it together. I can imagine the black case with the gold band and the red, slightly dark red with a rounded top. And we're taking this moment to like look at it as being important, significant, and meaningful. And as a way of honoring that relationship that you had, that you have with your mom. And I think that's really important to do.
Yeah, just as you were describing that, I'm feeling myself get emotional in this way of like allowing somebody to see my connection, my pain, my grief, what's important to me, like allowing somebody to see that, sharing that with somebody feels so powerful, being seen in my, like the complications of it, right? The grief, the love, the beautiful memory, the pain, having somebody there with you in that is, whew, that is powerful. Yeah,
I'm tearing up too, right? It is this witnessing all the complexities of it, the regret, the longing. I'm naming the emotions for myself. I'm not going to assume about you. But, you know, as much as I loved my mom and as good as our relationship was, there was regret, there was longing. And I think the belonging, sometimes I say the belongings can reveal our longings. And I think being able to look at items and see what meanings, what attachments we have to them can really help us identify, oh, this is the memory that I really do want to highlight. And, oh, there was a pain there that maybe I want to look at with my therapist or process in coaching and maybe let that go. So I find it so revealing.
That is, okay, I'm just going to have to repeat this because my brain is like going 100 miles now. The belonging reveals the longing.
Yeah, the belongings can reveal our longings.
Yeah, and then those longings and sharing those belongings with others and allowing those longings to be seen, it's bringing so much light to our humanity. It's bringing so much light to like, oh, it's not about the lipstick. It's about something so much more. And oh my goodness, this is, whew.
And it's the witnessing, this human need to be seen. To have it acknowledged and to have that loss witnessed, to have that love witnessed, to have the pain witnessed. That's a part of healthy grieving and processing that unfortunately a lot of people don't get. They don't get the community support. They don't get someone else witnessing it. And for some of us, just that experience of having someone witness what's happened, having someone witness and listen and acknowledge to what happened to us can be enough to help us let go of some of the things we do want to let go of. Yeah. So that's incredibly powerful in and of itself.
And I'm thinking this especially after coming out of dealing with, 3 years of pandemic and having, I mean, I have multiple friends who have lost somebody. There was no funeral. There was no gathering. There was no shared grief. There was no this witnessing of the pain and the grief. And so I could see how this, even opening it up to like a small group, like curating and then having like your friends or those you love.
Yes.
Even if it was just like in your home on your table, right? Like saying like that could be such a healing event when you didn't have that opportunity.
Yes.
And he's okay. Okay. I'm just like, whew. I don't even know. I'm bringing honestly.
How much just, you get it.
I think I'm also just kind of like experiencing it with you right now and just figuring it out.
Yeah, it can be cathartic. Absolutely. And, you know, when I think of that exhibition, that first exhibition I did with my mother's belongings, I often say it felt like the memorial I really wanted to give her. As I work with more clients who have different backgrounds, I've gotten the feedback that this idea of putting together an exhibition, of co-creating an exhibition, which is what I do with some clients, that it can be a really helpful way to bring in ceremony or ritual when you don't have a religion or are anti-religion. Or in my case, I don't really have that much access to whatever it is my ancestors did. So I think the whole exhibition and curating aspect is a part of me creating my own rituals and remixing what I know into my own form of having that kind of memorial, that kind of process, the ritual that, like you said, a lot of people have really been missing out on.
So often when you are creating a memorial or a funeral with other family members, it can be, first of all, everyone's emotionally charged. Second of all, you're coming from it from very different points of view, could be different religious views. And often a funeral can, I mean, I have talked to multiple people where they felt like I felt so disconnected or I was completely shut off during the funeral because that's not what she wanted. That's not in any way. I didn't feel connected to her in any way. So this is such a powerful way, I think, to create this personal memorial, this personal goodbye that you might not have got. Okay. This is cool. Okay. So I feel like I could talk about this for another 2 hours, but I want to get the rest of your story here. So this happened 2003. She passed away 2013. She passed away 2015. You had this exhibition. How did that turn into you creating this whole business, the grief gallery and this grief coaching?
Yeah, I would say that first exhibition was the seed for the grief gallery. And then I think there was that aspect of after you deal with someone dying and what I call that kind of proof of death stage where you're doing the paperwork and you're just telling people, yeah, she died and this is how she died and this is what we know and this is what we don't know. It shifts to what I call like proof of life, where you're really focusing on how did the person live and thus, what are some of the lessons there for me? How do I want to live? Because we very much get faced with our own mortality when we're dealing with these topics. And part of it was, I am doing work to help. Well, this was in New York by this time. And I had moved back to New York and I was working with design brands and doing communications consulting, which was fun, but it didn't really feel like my life's work or my calling. And I was thinking, well, if I was to have a stroke and die like my mother, do I want my legacy and my work to be, I wrote some good social media posts about chairs? It's like, no, that was not the legacy I wanted to leave. And I really did start to feel a calling to help other people and to feel that sense of, oh, a lot of people are in pain and a lot of people don't know how to talk about the pain. And it really shouldn't be this hard. It shouldn't feel this isolating when you lose someone. So I wanted to help people who are in their grief. And that's when I started looking back at why was that so helpful for me? And I started to do exhibitions as a way to say, okay, let's talk about grief. Let's talk about death in this accessible, creative way, which for me was exhibitions. Come into my gallery. I'll put on a nice display for you. You can look at my mom's objects. I'll tell you the stories. And then you're invited to share your stories. And that was really fantastic. And people really got that concept. And then I thought, okay, I think I can help people even more because there are other layers to working with the objects. Yeah. Because there's the physical stuff and then there's all the emotional stuff that's tied to it. So then I got certified as a coach and then I've been taking grief trainings and other certifications and learning about different grief theories and different approaches. And then I developed my own curating grief framework that ties in those elements of grief theory that we've talked about. And then I just have a whole bunch of concepts and analogies that I introduce to clients. And sometimes we do put together an exhibition. Sometimes we just talk about it.
Yeah. Which both can be so helpful, right? It depends on what that person needs. I think it's interesting how something so painful can reveal what I like to call the magic that we came here with. And it's the magic we have to heal ourselves and to heal our community around us. But so often it comes out in such hard way, right? So like your mom died in this like your job, it wasn't bad. You enjoyed it, but you're like, wait a second, this isn't fulfilling me. This feels like there's something more. And then saying, okay, look what I've just been through. So often what we go through is for the good of our community, right? Like I use what I have been through to help other women access their magic, to access their power. But it was painful to get here.
Yes.
But we have this ability to turn our pain, to alchemize it into something so beautiful. And that's what I see you doing. You've taken this painful experience that really lasted a decade, right? And still, like, the grief is still present. And you're saying,
oh, absolutely.
I can take this painful experience. I can alchemize it. I can add my gifts of art and curation and holding space for people and turn that into something so beautiful and powerful. And yeah, I'm just so grateful that you've done this work.
I love your enthusiasm.
Well, I'm just like, I'm being serious about like the work that you're doing is so powerful in this way that you're helping people release the weight and the shame, right? Like there's so much
weight,
shame that we put on ourselves in this grieving process.
Yes.
So,
and I love that you pointed out beautiful. Because I do think that's one of my motivations, that there's already so much ugliness inherent in the world and in these experiences, that if we can add beauty to help balance that out, that feels right to me. And like you said, it's painful. And sometimes I describe it as like this kind of loss, this kind of pain cracks your heart open. And some people deal with it by hardening it and closing off. But I feel like losing my mom cracked my heart open, and it's like it now has a hinge. And when I give talks and when I work with people, I feel like I crack my heart open using that hinge as an invitation for them to share what's in their own heart. And I do find that that's a constructive way to channel that pain and to channel my experience. And it doesn't feel heavy to me anymore. And I guess I want that for other people. I've seen so many people in my own family who have been weighed down for decades by unacknowledged losses, unprocessed grief, and all the meaning that they've taken from that and how it's impacted how they go through the world and through their lives. And I don't want that for other people. Like, I really want people to be able to move forward with their own lives. You have so much to offer. You want to change the world. I can see that, right? And it's going to help you. It's going to help me to be able to let go of the extra burden in order for us to do what we really want to do in the world.
Wow. That's such a beautiful picture of, it's almost like you're sharing. It's like you're mirroring the pain and giving a way to turn that into something so beautiful. And the grief is still there. The missing is still there. The longing is still there, but it's changed. It's morphed into a way. And it goes back to what I feel like you were saying before about being witnessed in it. Mm-hmm. And when you're sharing that and being witnessed, that's just, whew, okay.
It changes form.
It does.
Right? It doesn't disappear. But...
Yes. Yeah. And there's so much power in that. And there's so much beauty in that. Beauty in the pain, beauty in the grief, beauty in the sharing and the shared community in all of that. Mm-hmm. So I'm just so grateful for you and this work and that I found you and that I've had this conversation with you. And how can other people find you? How can they work with you?
Yeah. Well, one, I'm so glad that, I don't know, the universe brought us together.
Yes, me too.
I was like, Melissa, do you want to talk about our dead moms?
Yes. Yes, let's talk about our dead moms. That is literally how we connected.
I love talking to people about their dead moms. So I can talk about my dead mom.
Yes.
Or their dead dad. Or parental figures. Dead people. Yes. Dead
people. Just talk about dead people.
Yeah. And their things.
This would be a really weird place for someone to come in on this conversation.
Like, so who's your dead person? Tell me about their things. Yeah. So you can go to my website, CharleneLamb.com. If you go to CharleneLamb.com/hello, you'll find out about my monthly grief gathering. You can ask me questions and you can find out more about grief coaching and my curating grief framework. And I'm also on Instagram at curating_grief. Like, I love hearing from people.
Yeah, I will link all of that below in the show notes. And again, just thank you so much for the work that you're doing and this such unique way of approaching grief.
Oh, for thanks for your enthusiasm. Thanks for letting me talk about my dead mom.
Anytime.
She would love it. She would love that we met.
That's all for now, but I'm going to be back next Wednesday with another awesome episode. In the meantime, if you're feeling like you're on the first half of this life-changing awakening, you're ready for action, but you need clarity because you don't know what the hell to do next, then you've got to get on my email list. That's where I talk about walking with fear, gaining confidence, and living a life that serves you. You can sign up to receive my free guide called Unlocking Your Bad Bitch Magic. In this roadmap, you get the exact steps that I use to go from scared people pleaser to a confident badass, so that you can figure out your very next step. You can find it at melissalionwest.com/free or in the show notes below. Okay, I'll see you back here next week.
Hey guys, it's Miriam Love here, and I want to share something very special with you. Check out my new release, All In, the Spanish Remixes, out now on Electric House Records. And always remember, be love, share love, all love.
Available now wherever you listen to music.
Mile, are you ready to record our promo for season 2 of the Wanna Bet podcast?
David, have you ever seen a grown man naked?
Miles, we're not here to quote lines from Airplane. We're here to tell people that season 2 starts August 18th.
But I like Airplane.
I know you do, but Wanna Bet is a sports betting podcast. Each week we bet $1,000 on the NFL teams and games that we love.
Well, that sounds like fun.
It is fun. And last year you picked over 60% of your games correctly.
How'd you do?
We're not talking about that. We are telling people that they can find us every Friday. So no more movie quotes.
Roger, roger.
Electric acid. Electric acid.